Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In our Quran study session today, inshallah, I will talk about the Quran and divine law. There are two important questions that are often raised in discussion about Islam. The first question is the Quran a book of law? And if yes, it is a book of law, are these laws fixed and eternal? Two very important questions, and I'm sure those questions have crossed your mind. Well, in general, law teaches us how to behave properly. Law informs us of the rules that we should follow. Now, if we go by this definition, then yes, there are laws in the Quran. This much all Muslim scholars agree upon. But there is no consensus on the second question. Are the laws of the Quran permanent? Are the laws of the Quran eternal? Are they meant to be applicable to Muslims living in all societies across history and time? There is no consensus among Muslim scholars on this question. You see, over the past century, since after World War I, gradually two distinct camps emerged in Islamic scholarship. Camp A is occupied by conservatives or traditionalist scholars. Camp B is occupied by progressives or reformers. Now, these two camps today exist side by side in many, not all, of Muslim majority societies around the world. Now, Camp A believes that Quranic laws are fixed and permanent. Quranic laws are eternal, which means that Muslims today, whenever they are a majority in a nation, they must practice those laws. They must live by those laws. Camp B, the camp of reformists, argue, on the other hand, that there is no clear evidence in the Quran which would suggest that its laws were meant to be seen as permanent, that those laws were meant to be seen as eternal. You see, here we should not confuse law and value. Law and value are two different things. Law is derived from value. It's not synonymous with value. And yes, the values that are embedded in the laws of the Quran are eternal. Our job as Muslims in modern society, for example, is to figure out what value is embedded in a given law of the Quran. Then we can craft a new law based on that value, which would be more in line with the realities of our time. As you all know, I belong to the reformist camp. So let me articulate the reformist position on Islamic law, or what in the Western literature today is called Sharia. Just FYI, the concept of Sharia in the Holy Quran is much broader than law. But in Western literature these days, they refer to Sharia as Islamic law. And in my talk today, I may use the two terms interchangeably. So let's begin. The reformist position on Islamic law, or more specifically, Quranic laws. You see, the Quran consists of 6,600 plus verses. However, there are only about 350 verses, that deal with law in general. So there are only, of the 6,600 plus verses in the Quran, we only have about 350 law verses, or about roughly 5% of the Quran concerns law. Now, these 350 verses are typically divided into two broad categories. The first category is called ibadat, or rituals. The second category is called mu'amilat, or social relations. Mu'amilat essentially are laws that deal with social, economic, and judicial affairs. So two categories of law verses in the Quran: ibadat, or rituals; mu'amilat, or social relations. Now, ibadat, or rituals, primarily regulate a Muslim's relation with God. Mu'amilat, on the other hand, or social relations, regulate a Muslim's relation with other human beings. And that's the crucial difference between the two categories of laws in the Quran. Out of the 350 verses that deal with law, 140 fall in the category of ibadat, or rituals. Practices such as ritual daily prayer, or salat, namaz, fasting, siyam, or saum, and also the Hajj pilgrimage. These are examples of ibadat, or ritual verses, in the Quran. 140 verses fall in this category. The other 210 verses deal with social relations, or mu'amilat. Let me give you some examples of social relations topics for which the Quran has laws. Marriage, or nikah, divorce, talaq, inheritance, irs, adultery and fornication, zina, also property and contract obligations, and regulation for warfare. These are some topics in the Quran for which we can find laws. Now, rules and laws concerning ibadat, rituals, and mu'amilat, social relations, differ in one important respect. So this is crucial, please pay attention. Laws concerning rituals and social relations differ in one very critical respect. Ibadat, or rituals, by their very nature, are not subject to change. Why? Because their subject matter does not change. What is the subject matter of ibadat, or rituals? Human relation with God. That does not change. When we go from one form of society, let's say agrarian, to another society, which is industrial, right? Human relationship with God does not change. For example, we do not need to change the number of times we pray every day. We don't need to change the number of days we fast in a year. We don't need to change the rituals of Hajj. So ibadat, by their very nature, are fixed. The laws concerning ibadat or rituals are therefore eternal. But mu'amilat or social relation laws is an entirely different issue. The subject matter of these laws, which is society, changes over time. What is the subject matter of social relations laws? Society. Societies change over time. Let me give you one example. So hopefully that will make it clear to you where I'm heading towards. Consider the Quranic law on theft. The subject matter of theft is violation of property right. That's the subject matter of theft. Now, in Prophet Muhammad's time, property was mostly physical things, right? Like jewelry, sword, carpet. So property in Prophet Muhammad's time were mostly physical things. Today, the subject matter property has broadened significantly. Today, we have intellectual property. Today, knowledge is considered property. Movies and songs are also property. They can be stolen too, right? So we need to have new regulations. So, the notion that social laws must be permanent is flawed at its core. Societies evolve. Social relations evolve. They typically grow more and more complex. As social circumstances change, so should the laws that must regulate them. There is another flaw in the common perception of Islamic law. Now, this may sound even more controversial to many of you. There is another flaw in the common perception of Islamic law. When we say, quote-unquote, Islamic, most people are under the false impression that it was the Prophet Muhammad who established these laws for the first time. Otherwise, why would we call them Islamic, right? So most people are under the false perception that it was the Prophet Muhammad who established these laws that we find in the Quran, the social relation laws, for the first time. Most people incorrectly believe that it was the Quran that introduced these laws. And that's why they are called Islamic. This is not true. This is not true at all. Almost all social relation laws, mu'amilat, existed in Arabia before the Prophet Muhammad was even born. The Prophet Muhammad, all he did, he endorsed those practices. He accepted them as legitimate, and then those practices found their way into the Quran. Prophet Muhammad endorsed and accepted many practices of the tribal society of Arabia in his times for two reasons. And these two reasons are very, very critical. Number one, those practices that the Prophet Muhammad endorsed were customs of the time. Those practices were well known to the peoples of the time. Or in the Quranic language, they were ma'ruf. Those laws, those practices really worked. Those practices worked in their time. And secondly, the Prophet Muhammad had a simple criterion for accepting or rejecting a social practice. What was his criterion? Conformity and compatibility with two overarching principles of Islam: Tawheed and Adl, unity and justice. This was essentially the criterion of the Prophet Muhammad for endorsing a social practice of his time: conformity, compatibility with Tawheed, unity, and Adl, justice and fairness. In the 1970s, the late Iraqi scholar and historian Dr. Jawad Ali wrote a groundbreaking book which is titled Al-Mufassal fi Tarikh al-Arab qabl al-Islam, The History of the Arabs Before Islam, a very, very important book. There are 10 volumes to this book. This book is so important that after its publication, it quickly became one of the most referenced books on Arab history before Islam. In that book, Dr. Ali shows quite clearly and convincingly that pretty much all the social relation laws of the Quran existed before the Prophet Muhammad. That's one of the things that Dr. Jawad Ali clearly shows in his masterpiece, The History of the Arabs Before Islam. Let me give you some examples of the sort of practices that the Prophet Muhammad endorsed, and by his endorsement they found their way into the Quran. Bay'ah, giving consent or a pledge, was practiced by Arabs before Islam. The Prophet Muhammad endorsed that practice, and bay'ah, or giving pledge, became a custom amongst Muslims as well. And also we have this notion of bay'ah, or consent or pledge, in the Quran as well. Shawra, consultation, that was also a common practice among tribal chiefs in Arabia. This practice was also endorsed and made its way into the Quran. Let me give you one example of that. Chapter 42, verse 38. وَأَمْرُهُمْ شُورَى بَيْنَهُمْ. Consult your affairs with mutual consultation. That's what the Quran asks Muslims to do. وَأَمْرُهُمْ شُورَى بَيْنَهُمْ. Conduct your affairs with mutual consultation. That was a customary practice even before Islam. Nikah, or marriage. This should be really interesting to all of you. Nikah, or marriage, as you know, we have a law for that in the Quran. In Arabia before Islam, a variety of different marriage practices existed. Let me give you the most important, common, and recognized types of marriage at that time in Arabia before Islam. Marriage by agreement. In this type of marriage, a man would marry a woman, but that marriage was based on an agreement between the man and his future wife's family, not the groom and the bride, but between the groom and the bride's family. Marriage by dowry, or marriage by mahr. That was another type of marriage in Arabia. The groom or the groom's father would pay the bride an amount to show that the groom is fully capable of supporting the bride financially after marriage. Another type of marriage in Arabia: marriage by capture. Marriage by capture. You see, those days in war, it was a common practice for women of the defeated tribes to be taken captive. Those captive women were often sold either into slavery or into marriage. In other words, men could buy their wives. That was one type of marriage in Arabia. Marriage by inheritance. When a man died, his son inherited all his wives except his own mother. There was another form of marriage that I'm sure you've heard about. Temporary marriage, mut'a, or siqe as it is known in Iran. At that time, a man and a woman could get married for a specified period of time. So these were the primary or the most common types of marriages in Arabia. Of all these customary forms of marriage in Arabia, the Quran accepted marriage by mahr, marriage by dowry. The Islamic prescribed marriage or nikah is a contract. This contract is not between the groom and the bride's family. This contract is between the groom and the bride. And the groom must pay mahr, dowry or gift to the bride. And this sum must be paid at the time of marriage, and that sum is for the bride's exclusive use. The notion of talaq or divorce, which exists in the Quran, also existed in Arabia before Islam. The Prophet Muhammad endorsed the divorce or talaq law that existed in Arabia. The Prophet Muhammad approved this practice. Now, in some cases, the Prophet Muhammad, before accepting a practice, he would make modifications to that practice. I would personally rather frame it as the Prophet Muhammad reformed some common practices, right? The Prophet Muhammad, in some cases, reformed some common practices in the interest of advancing justice and fairness in his time. Do we remember one of the criterion of the Prophet Muhammad was, is this social practice of my time fair? Is it just? So, sometimes we find instances where the Prophet Muhammad made adjustments, modifications to an existing rule, an existing practice in the interest of advancing justice. Let me give you a couple of examples from the Quran. The notion of inheritance or irs existed in Arab society. However, at that time, only adult men were entitled to inheritance. The Prophet Muhammad found this practice to be unfair. He found this practice to be unjust. So he reformed the inheritance law of his time. He said, going forward, women shall inherit property. And that's precisely what you find in the Holy Quran. Chapter 4, verse 7. Men shall have a share in what their parents and closest relatives leave. And women shall have a share in what their parents and closest relatives leave. Be it little or much, it is ordained. Let me give you another example of a practice that existed in Arabia, and the Prophet Muhammad modified it before endorsing it. Qisas. qisas or retribution. Qisas or retribution is a corporal punishment for physical injury, most notably murder in the Quran. Now, qisas, retribution, existed in Arabia, especially among the Jewish tribes in Medina. Eye for an eye. That's part of the Jewish Bible, right? The Old Testament. Just FYI, the main purpose for qisas or retribution was to clamp down on tribal feud and vendetta. Because at that time, if one person in tribe A was killed by a person in tribe B, then what would happen is that the folks in tribe A would go on a killing spree. They would kill as many people in the offending tribe as they could lay their hands on. So qisas or retribution stopped this practice. The Quran embraced qisas. The Prophet Muhammad endorsed qisas, but he made an important adjustment to this practice, which we find in the Holy Quran. Chapter 42, verse 40. The recompense, the compensation for an injury, is an injury equal to it in degree. Okay, so that's eye for an eye in the Hebrew Bible. The recompense, the compensation for an injury, is an injury equal to it in degree. But whoever pardons and sets matters aright, his reward is with God. Truly, God does not love those who do wrong. What was the adjustment to qisas or retribution? Pardon and forgiveness. The Quran's position on dealing with injury sits right in between Judaism and Christianity. Judaism prescribes an eye for an eye. Christianity, on the other hand, preaches forgiveness for an injury. The Quran simultaneously embraces both. The Quran recognizes the right of the injured person to seek justice. But it suggests that it is better for the injured person to forgive. If she forgives, her reward, her compensation will be paid by God. One more example, okay, just one more example of a modified Arab social practice that appears in the Quran. Khums. Khums literally means one-fifth. This commandment, the commandment for khums, appears only once in the Quran, in chapter 8, verse 41. And here it is. Know that one-fifth of your battle gains, spoils of war, belongs to God and the Messenger, to close relatives and orphans, to the needy and travelers. So the verse says, hey, when you go to war and you win, the spoils of war, you can't have all of it to yourself. You should give one-fifth of that to God, the Prophet, close relatives, orphans, the needy, and travelers. Now, here is the point, though. In pre-Islamic Arabia, there was a custom or a practice called rub' or one-fourth. One-fourth. Tribal chiefs used to receive one-fourth of the spoils of war. That served like a rainy day fund in modern governments. So the chiefs of tribes back then would spend that wealth on purposes that they deemed necessary for the tribe. And here is the catch. The Prophet Muhammad kept that practice, the practice of giving a portion of the spoils of war to the chief of the tribe. He kept that practice, but lowered the amount from 1/4 to 1/5. That was the Prophet's reform to the accepted tribal practice. Now, all the examples that I mentioned, these are some examples of pre-existing social practices, social laws that made their way into the Quran. As Dr. Javad Ali and other researchers have convincingly showed, almost all social relation laws, mu'amilat, of the Quran have their roots in pre-Islamic Arabia. They were endorsed by Islam, not created by Islam. There is a huge difference between creating a practice and endorsing a practice. The Prophet Muhammad showed his followers how to enact laws. So now I'm drawing general broad conclusion from everything I said today. The Prophet Muhammad showed his followers how to enact laws. Number one, respect the norms and customs of your time, unless they are contrary to the core teachings and values of your faith. That's the first point you have to have in mind when you enact laws. Secondly, ensure that your laws are just and fair, as the inheritance example that I mentioned earlier clearly showed. In times of the Prophet Muhammad, only adult males were entitled to inheritance. Prophet Muhammad reformed that law to make it fairer, more just to women. Honestly, when I consider the lot of women in Arabia before the Prophet Muhammad, and also the reforms that the Prophet Muhammad introduced to improve the lives of women in his time, I can even argue that the Prophet Muhammad was a feminist in his time. The Prophet Muhammad, in my opinion, can be called a feminist for his time because of the reforms that he introduced in favor of women in his time. The Prophet Muhammad taught his followers that social and judicial reform is an ongoing project. Social and judicial reform is a never-ending project. When it came to social affairs, the Prophet Muhammad had two primary attributes. First, he was a progressive. Secondly, he was a realist. He was at the same time a progressive and a realist. History is full of progressives who make proclamations. There must not be any poor person in society. All people must have equal access to public resources. Well, these are great ideals. These are great proclamations. But I tell you, no society can ever achieve these noble goals. They are good ideals to have, but you need to be realistic. A realist would say, given the realities of my time, given the constraints that I'm facing, how can I make things better? This is the model of the Prophet Muhammad, progressive realism. idealists say we must have a perfect society. Realists, on the other hand, say we must have a more perfect society, a society that is more perfect than yesterday. That's how I understand the Prophet Muhammad's tradition or sunnah, progressive realism. Muslims must be open to new possibilities in social formations. Muslims should be open to new social relations. Rather than being stuck in the past, they must be creative and forward-thinking as the Prophet Muhammad was. So, in conclusion, when God says, لَقَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولُ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنَةٌ, surely the Messenger of God is an excellent model for you, it literally means that the Prophet Muhammad is an excellent role model for Muslims in all times, including in the 21st century. The Prophet is our role model, not just in personal ethics and character building, not just in spiritual matters. He is also our role model in social and political affairs. Well, I'm just warming up, but unfortunately, we have already run out of time and I have to cut short this important topic, and inshallah, I will continue this important subject in my next sermon. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.